This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Racing's impact on this city is about $6 billion a year and accounts for about 25,000 jobs. Some of the economic impact of racing on Charlotte comes from the fact that nearly 90% of all racing teams are based in this region, but still more money is funneled into the region's economy during the race weeks at Charlotte Motor Speedway each spring and fall, and this is one of those weeks with the Bank of America 500 scheduled for this Saturday. In advance of that, we take a closer look at racing's impact on Charlotte and the impact on racing of changes in technology and in the people behind the wheel. Some key drivers are leaving the sport at the end of this season and next, and one racing team is shutting down at season's end. Here to talk about all of that and more is Dr. Deandra Leslie Pilecki, a former physics professor and author of The Physics of NASCAR. She also blogs about the science of auto racing at Building Speed and appears every other Friday on the SiriusXM Speedway satellite radio program, and just recently completed a pilot for TV about racing. She's been on this program before. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Nice to have you. Doug Rice is president of Performance Racing Network and a veteran NASCAR announcer. He's been covering the sport since 1980 and currently co-anchors PRN race broadcasts for the NASCAR Sprint Cup and Xfinity Series. The next Xfinity race is Friday night at Charlotte Motor Speedway. He also serves as a member of the board of directors of the National Motorsports Press Association and the National Sportscaster and Sports Writer Association. Thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure to be here. Always good to do a little bench racing.
We have two big race weeks every year, one in May, one in October. What do these races, Doug, mean to Charlotte?
I think they mean a lot to Charlotte. They were Charlotte's sports identity for quite a long time. Before there were the Charlotte Hornets or the Charlotte Panthers, there was Charlotte Motor Speedway, and that was the sports identity for this area. So I think it means a great deal to this area on a national sports scene as far as coverage is concerned, and also the economic impact of having, you know, a few hundred thousand people show up on your doorstep. Yeah. And camping and staying in the area hotels and spending lots of money.
Do most people stay in the hotels, or most people bring their RVs and sit in the infield for most of the
I would venture to say that it's probably a bigger impact for people in the camping universe staying in the infield or the adjacent campgrounds than probably stay in the area hotels. But I would think if you own a property along Speedway Boulevard or Bruton Smith Boulevard, you've probably been booked up for a while.
Yeah. When they were trying to attract the NASCAR Hall of Fame here, proponents of bringing it to town used the tagline, racing was built here, racing belongs here. Is that something the hierarchy of NASCAR believes? Is that something other sports aficionados, other Speedway owners believe as well? Or is that just something we made up and it stuck?
It seemed to have stuck pretty well. I do not think, and of course I am biased because I have worked with Charlotte Motor Speedway through the Performance Racing Network for quite a while. I don't think that there was another city that had a real legitimate claim to have the NASCAR Hall of Fame over Charlotte and the area. I just don't know how that could have been. The only one that I felt like that could have even come close would have been Daytona Beach because mm-hmm. of their heritage with the Daytona International Speedway and what that speedway means. But when you just look at the geography and the fact that, as you pointed out, the race teams are in this area, this is the heartbeat of NASCAR. Charlotte Motor Speedway, the location of the race teams, even NASCAR has moved a lot of its support right here into this area. I just feel like that was sort of a fait accompli that the hall would go here.
Deandra, we're going to talk about how you got interested in this, because as I said, you were a physics professor, still are a physicist, and you do other things now. You write a lot about NASCAR, and I said, why are you here? Because you live in the D.C. suburbs. Well, you're here because the race is going on this week, and you're here to interview some teams, and because you do this ongoing blog, and you're involved in broadcasting on SiriusXM talking about racing. And you said something that actually struck a chord with me, that racing is today and has always been a people sport.
It is. I think people who aren't familiar with NASCAR racing don't realize how many people it takes to actually get a car onto the track. For every car, you've probably got a staff of about 100 people back at the shop working on it. Increasingly, a large number of those folks are people with PhDs and master's degrees in engineering.
Mm. But is it also a people sport because the guys, the drivers, and they're all guys at the moment, except for, I think, one woman, those people are really the marquee. They're the talent. They are the spotlight. That's who the spotlight hits. People follow them.
People follow the drivers, definitely, and they're mostly charismatic, sometimes controversial figures.
Yeah.
But you also notice when they win a race, the first thing they do is thank everybody there at the race at the racetrack and back in the shop.
So it is a team effort.
It is a team effort.
They're not just talking. They mean it. NASCAR started to get really, really hot several years ago, and then began to expand its influence across the country. And then it started on a decline for some reason. TV viewership began to plunge 21% from 2005 highs. Advertising revenues down 16%. Attendance at the tracks crashed, so they slashed ticket prices. Now things seem to be reversing on an upward trend again. Why? What was responsible for the crash? What's responsible for the reversal of fortunes?
Taking part of the popularity in the late 90s and the early 2000s, I don't think it was ever as popular as we wanted to believe it was, because it just skyrocketed. So immediately everybody thought, okay, we've captured the country. It did go from being predominantly a southeastern-based sport to a national sport, and it still is, with tracks located from one side of the country to the other. So we may have been a little over-optimistic about how popular it was in 2000. I think part of the decline is some people came in, sampled it, and said, okay, I've been there, done that. I'm going to go try something else. And they moved on to follow other sports. And also, I think part of it is just the cyclical nature of all sports. I mean, if you look at almost every sport in this country, taking the NFL out of the equation, they go through cycles of popularity. 10 years ago, the NBA was at a low point. They said, oh, there's never going to be any more stars. There's nothing to propel it. And all of a sudden, LeBron James and a couple of other key players come along, and the sport goes back up. And I think the same with NASCAR. I think it went through cycles. And I do feel like in the last couple of years, it's on an uptick. And one of the biggest reasons, Mike, I feel like, is the new format of the chase and the way they decide the championship. American sports fans love a playoff, and that's what NASCAR has now.
And last night, I'm told, Jimmy Johnson got knocked out of the chase. Is that right?
He did. They suffered a rear axle early in the race. They were out for, I believe, 37 laps fixing it. And he finished, what, like 43rd, 42nd?
He finished way down the list and out of the money as far as he will remain a six-time champion, at least for one more season, because he cannot win the title this year. And that's a huge upset. At least I never dreamed that he would be eliminated in the first round.
And that's the other part of this, because it's not just the player, the star athlete, that either wins or loses or succeeds or fails. He's at the mercy of his equipment. And the equipment in this case failed.
Yeah, and there aren't things you can usually predict. You know, everyone, they go over the car with a fine-tooth comb trying to get everything ready. But things happen. You accidentally bump into someone else on track. You hit the wall. Nothing you can do about that.
Maybe it's just a function of where we live, but I don't hear much about Formula One outside of the Indianapolis 500. Now, do other parts of the country follow that kind of racing more than they follow NASCAR? Or is it just NASCAR somehow eclipsed Formula One?
Well, Formula One is an international form of motorsports.
Which is why we don't like it.
And it is really not about television audience, especially in the United States, or even it is this huge international party that moves from site to site. And it's never going to capture the mass appeal that, say, IndyCar racing, which is the Indianapolis 500, or stock car racing has. I don't even think it's designed for that. It's got its niche, but it's a much smaller niche in popularity, especially in the United States.
Doctor.
One of the problems with that is just not having very many American F1 drivers. Mm-hmm. And Gene Haas, who is a co-owner of Stuart Haas Racing, a NASCAR team, is starting an F1 team. So it'll be the first American-based F1 team. And they have said there really aren't any American drivers who are ready for Formula One, but their eventual hope is to get an American driver as an F1 driver and try to raise interest in the sport here.
You became interested in racing as a physicist, and we'll talk about exactly what that moment in time was, because when you were here, I think it was in 2006, we talked a lot about that, and I think that deserves a recap. But you could have been interested in Formula One, because it's physics, too. What was it about NASCAR versus Formula One that attracted your attention and interest and your study?
So I have to say, before I actually started working in NASCAR, I was not a racing fan. I knew nothing about racing. And not only did I know nothing about racing, I pretty much knew nothing about cars. So you might think someone, you know, with a background like mine would be more interested in F1 or Indy cars because technically they are a lot more sophisticated. But NASCAR was really the perfect entree for me because the cars are fairly straightforward and they don't use technology where it's pretty much a computer driving the car. It's really based on the drivers. So for me, that entree was much easier. And then the other thing was people at NASCAR wanted to talk to me. I mean, I went and asked questions, and I'm running into people who have PhDs like me,
right.
Who are talking to me in my own language, and they invited me everywhere. I was just amazed at how much access I got.
And we'll talk about technology and what you discovered about technology and some of the technological changes that are taking place even as we speak, as we go through the program this morning on Charlotte Talks. NBC renewed the TV rights for NASCAR after dropping them in 2006, and NBC Sports Chairman Mark Lazarus calls NASCAR one of the most popular sports. He says it's an all-star game every weekend where you have the best athletes on the same playing surface at the same time. That'd be like putting all of the great players in the NFL in the same game. Is that what he's saying?
Yes, exactly. That's one of the beauties about NASCAR Sprint Cup racing. If you buy a ticket to go see them race in Chicagoland or Atlanta or Charlotte, you are guaranteed to see all of the players show up for every race, not just your favorites, but they are all going to be there. It is literally an all-star race every time they race. And even as you go through the chase and they eliminate drivers from championship contention, Jimmy Johnson will still be racing this weekend at Charlotte with a chance to win the race. And it truly is an all-star race every time they drop a green flag.
Is there a downside to that? I mean, it's like when I was a kid, tomatoes were in season for part of the year and then you didn't get tomatoes in the wintertime. And then suddenly they were back and it was a treat. If you see the same people week in and week out during the season, is there anything to look forward to? Like that big race is coming up in 3 months, and I get to see Jeff Gordon in that race. He's in every race.
I think what has happened in this sport, and Doctor, you can chime in on this, is that some races have elevated the events themselves are bigger than others in the minds of the fans.
Mm-hmm.
The Coca-Cola 600 at Charlotte Motor Speedway, huge, huge event. The Daytona 500, Darlington, the Brickyard. Those events are bigger. But as far as there being an oversupply of all-stars, no, I don't think that's an issue at all.
And what about the impact of the venue? Because the venue changes from week to week, and the venues are different, and it changes the race, doesn't it?
It certainly does, and some drivers are much better at some tracks than other drivers. So, for example, when we go to Talladega and Daytona, two super speedways, there are some drivers who are just really good there, and it also gives other drivers who normally don't win a chance to win. One of the ironic things about Jimmy Johnson being knocked out of the chase last night is it was at Dover, a track he's won at 10 times in the past, a track he's usually very good at.
What makes a driver good at one track and not good at another? What is that? What's that about?
The driver has to feel comfortable in their car. You'll hear people talking about drivers drive by the seat of their pants. It really is a feel. You are one with the car. And so being able to engineer the car for a particular track so that that car feels like you can push it is really the most critical thing.
We're talking to Dr. DeAndre Leslie Pilecki, who's the physicist and the author of The Physics of NASCAR. Doug Rice is not a physicist. He's a race guy.
Absolutely.
He's president of Performance Racing Network and a veteran announcer there. We're going to stop for just a second. When we come back, we're going to talk about technology. We'll get into some retirements coming our way and to some other aspects of racing that makes racing racing when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. DeAndre Leslie Pilecki is with us, physicist and author of The Physics of NASCAR, and Doug Rice, president of the Performance Racing Network and a longtime announcer. Let's talk a minute about physics here, doctor. You taught physics. You've done a lot of research into nanoparticles, medical diagnosis and treatment. You have over 60 peer-reviewed scientific papers, and yet you're on this program talking about racing. What is Why your interest in racing?
You know, when I first got interested in NASCAR, I'm talking to people and learning about it, and really from the ground up. And as I'm learning, I'm thinking, you know, this is exactly the stuff I'm supposed to be teaching my first year physics students. And it just seems so much more interesting at 200 miles an hour.
But you got interested, if I understand this correctly, if I remember this from our last conversation, you were interested in aerodynamics of race cars and interested in kinematics, which is the movement, I guess, of race cars, chemistry, physiology that underlies racing. What is the chemistry that underlies racing? The fuel?
Combustion.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of energy you need to run a NASCAR race car, you know, is amazing if you look at those kinds of scales. So you've got the combustion. Combustion for an internal combustion engine is exactly like the process of respiration, which is how our bodies run.
And you were watching a race just by happenstance, and you noticed this little wiggle in a car, and the car ended up crashing into the wall, and that got you to thinking?
Yeah, because I couldn't see why it happened. Now, if you would ask any NASCAR fan, they would say, oh, took the air off the spoiler, lost his rear grip, ran into the wall. I didn't know that. It wasn't obvious to me. So I looked, I started asking questions. The more questions I asked, the more I realized, my gosh, this is really interesting. And all the stuff I'm trying to explain to my students why they should know, it's all right here.
And when you used, or did you use NASCAR examples in the classroom? Because you no longer teach. You did use them. And when you used them, were the kids more engaged? Were they race people? Did they understand it because that's something they had seen either in person or on television?
We've all come off the expressway onto a cloverleaf going just a little too fast and felt ourselves going out right to the outside of the turn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's physics, right?
Right.
We've all tried to stop, and it's been wet, and we haven't stopped as quickly as we thought. That's physics. And so relating the physics to what they do and not to balls rolling down inclined planes actually makes them understand physics is useful. You use physics every day of your life, and you know a lot more physics than you think. We just try to hide it behind a whole bunch of fancy words and names and processes and things.
In the course of writing her book, Doug, The Physics of NASCAR, she talked to a lot of pit crews and pit bosses, and she's already talked about how they were forthcoming and welcomed her in. In fact, they wanted to talk to her because everybody in the garage today uses science, and a lot of them are PhDs. They understand physics. I would think that would not have been the case in the early days of stock car racing. You've been covering this sport for a long time, so when did you start noticing, if you did, a more scientific approach being applied to all of this?
Charlotte Motor Speedway hosts this thing called the Media Tour, and we used to haul around 3 busloads of media to all of the race shops. And this was probably 15 years ago that we went to Ray Evernham's shop in Statesville. Maybe 10 years ago. So we're rolling in there, and this is when he had brought Dodge back into the sport. And it was a very elaborately staged press conference, lots of mood lighting and music. And then all of a sudden, Ray comes out, and he goes, I want to introduce the backbone of my race team. And you're thinking, okay, we're going to meet the crew chief, and we'll meet the driver. And suddenly, a dozen guys in white coats and lab coats come out, and he introduces his engineering team. And I stood there and I went, okay, the worm is turned. You know, here's a lot of guys with names I can't pronounce that all have degrees that are building a better mousetrap for NASCAR. And it was at that moment when I saw that happen, and now that's pretty much the status quo for every race team, to have a group of people that do nothing but high-end research to make these cars go faster. But that's the first day that it dawned on me, okay, we have moved away from having a toolkit and wrenches to having CAD programs.
Wow, you were nodding and chuckling in recognition of that, Doctor. Were you there that day, or is this something you've heard about?
It's sort of a legendary story you
okay.
hear about.
All right.
But I think one of the interesting things is sort of the shifts we've seen, because for a while, every team was looking for crew chiefs who were engineers.
Right.
And sometimes that works. But one of the things people don't appreciate about NASCAR is the most important thing is the communication between the crew chief who fixes the car and the driver who drives the car. Engineers are not necessarily renowned for their communication skills. So we've now gone back to seeing people who may have an engineering degree, but they also have a lot of racing background being crew chiefs.
How technological are these cars today versus 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 25 years ago?
They're lightsabers to swords, as far as I'm concerned. Today's NASCAR stock car being a lightsaber compared to an iron sword from 25 years ago.
Because when you get in one, it's pretty bare bones. It's not like being in a luxury car. But it's all under the hood, isn't it?
It's under the hood, but increasingly it's moving into the driver's compartment. So, for example, next year we'll be using digital dashboards, and they will display for the driver a whole lot of information. They'll be able to understand things like their rate of fuel usage, for example, their speed on pit road. And these are all things that if you would have mentioned 5 years ago, people would have said, no way, we will never have that in NASCAR.
When you got all that information coming at you while you're driving the car at hundreds of miles an hour, how can you ingest that information, process that information, and use that information?
Well, that's part of the challenge. I mean, the better drivers will be able to assimilate all of that information and apply it to the race car. I was at the Indianapolis 500 this year working in the pits for Montoya, who went on to win the race, and his crew chief during the race kept telling Juan, he said, remember to use your tools. And at first I'm going like, I don't know what he's talking about. And I went over and asked him, I said, what is he saying? Because Juan can do a lot of things in the car. He can control a lot of things in the car on his cockpit. And his crew chief is reminding him, you have all these tools at your disposal. Don't forget to use them. Not quite as much so in a NASCAR stock car, but Doctor, I feel like it's moving more in that direction.
It is moving more in that direction, and it's actually a little controversial because one of the things NASCAR has always prided itself on is how important the driver is. If you go to an F1 race, they've got, you know, all the information from the car is going back to a computer, and there's a whole slew of engineers who are monkeying with the car while it's on the track. And you know, people don't want NASCAR to be like that. So NASCAR struggled to find a balance between technological and keeping that driver at the center of focus.
Well, I was going to ask you about the computer aspect of this, because if all this digital information is coming in beginning next year on the dashboard of these cars, is it being processed in some way, or does it have to be processed by the driver? Could it not say you're using it? Couldn't the computer know you're using X amount of fuel to do whatever it is you're doing? And couldn't the computer just say, ease up, or mash the pedal to the metal? I mean, couldn't it be simplified for the driver?
So that's one of the neat things that NASCAR is letting the team sort of experiment with what works best for them.
Ah.
And look, some of the drivers are, I don't want to say smarter, but quicker than others. Some drivers are very intuitive. Some are very technical. And so I think the teams will be able to figure out how to manipulate that information so that the driver gets what he or she needs and not any more, because they'll be overloaded.
You talk to the drivers a lot, I would imagine. Doug, do they want this in the car? Or are there purists out there who just want to drive?
I think most of them would go low tech if they had their druthers, because they want it to be as much about them and not the machine. And I think that's one of the things that NASCAR is very conscious about. They don't want the driver to be a passenger in the car. They want that driver to be fully engaged and to be able to make a difference. And so they're not going to let the technology get so far ahead of them that the driver just becomes a passenger.
Because there was a big story yesterday on 60 Minutes about driverless cars. The Google version and the Mercedes version and other manufacturers are working on this too. And although the Google car only goes 25 miles an hour, the Mercedes is fully capable of navigating interstate highways at speed. So you could, at some point down the road, I suppose, have driverless NASCAR cars, couldn't you?
But who would want that?
Why?
Yeah, I mean, that would take, you know, I don't know that anybody would pay money to see that in person or watch it on television.
Now, Doctor, you say that in the last 15 years, NASCAR did a 180 on safety and became proactive in increasing safety. Has that reduced the number of wrecks, reduced the number of accidents, injuries, deaths, etc.?
It has definitely reduced the number of deaths. There has not been a death in one of NASCAR's three major series since 2001 and the loss of Dale Earnhardt Sr. It has reduced injuries. I don't think it's reduced wrecks. And this actually may be an issue as the younger drivers are coming on. You know, there are very few drivers now in the series who have been on track when a driver was killed. And I think some of these younger drivers, and Doug, you may have talked to some of them, I think a few of them feel like they're indestructible, and they feel like they're just little pinballs bouncing off the edges.
Well, there was that horrific wreck earlier this season that we saw all over the TV news where the car literally just exploded. It just disintegrated, and the driver got out of it and walked away.
A car disintegrating is actually good because it means all the kinetic energy. So a race car going 180 miles an hour has the same amount of energy as is in 2.2 pounds of TNT.
Whoa.
Okay, so when a car stops, all that energy has to go somewhere. And what NASCAR has done with their car design is figure out how to make sure that energy goes anywhere except through the driver. So when you see a part flying off the car, that's good because that's not energy going through the driver, it's going through the car.
Nobody wants to see these drivers hurt, not even the most rabid fan of one driver over the other. But isn't a wreck what they come to see in part?
It is part of the attraction, and I'm not going to say that it's not, because it's always been a part of the sport that crashes are exciting and people stand up to look at them. I don't think this is like the Roman Colosseum, though, that people ever want to see somebody get hurt. And the wrecks or the anticipation of a wreck is a part of the attraction of the mm-hmm. sport. But fortunately, NASCAR has done a wonderful job in the last 15 years of making these cars so much safer. And they built literally a cocoon around the driver. That's how they describe it a lot of times. It's an area of safety for these drivers, and they never stop. If they have a crash, and they'll bring cars back to the Research and Development Center not far from Charlotte Motor Speedway and literally go over them inch by inch to find out what can we do better next time mm-hmm. to prevent further injury.
Wow. There have been injuries, fewer injuries, but you're saying that the injuries now that are left behind, the ones that still occur, are mostly to the driver's feet and legs. They've been able to protect his torso, his arms, his head. What's going on with the feet and legs?
Well, it's a difficult area to protect because if you crash head first, that area is – the driver's legs are probably the thing that's furthest towards the front of the car.
Right.
And then you've got pedals. Because you've got the throttle and the clutch and the brake. And so you have to worry about the driver's legs getting tangled up in those. And so I think that's really the next area where the focus is. But even if you look back, it was what Dario Franchitti broke his ankle
right.
in an Xfinity race, and that must have been 10 years ago.
Hmm. So what have they do to protect the head, the torso, et cetera? How have they been able to build this cocoon around that part of the driver?
Well, some of it is the chassis. And although we were talking about this before we went on air, the car of tomorrow was extremely unpopular. The car of tomorrow, which was the Generation 5 car, really gave us this very strong chassis that was tested to protect the driver. And then on top of that, you have increasingly better belt systems, head and neck restraints, fireproof suits. You know, it's pretty comprehensive.
How have these technological changes, these safety things, impacted racing and impacted the fans?
Well, I think, one, that it's probably extended the careers of some of these drivers because they're not getting beat up like they used to. I mean, mm-hmm. if you go back and you talk to Darrell Waltrip or Kyle Petty, they all had, at one point or another, a compound fracture or a broken hip or a dislocated shoulder. These guys got beat up week in and week out. I'm not saying that they're racing in luxury cars now, but they don't suffer the kind of physical damage that they used to in racing these cars. And I think you could see a career be extended easy into the mid-40s now. I mean, that's what Jeff Gordon is. He's 45 as he's stepping aside.
Wow. Friend of mine, big rabid NASCAR fan, but she likes to watch the truck races more than the NASCAR races because she says the NASCAR races have become too predictable. The trucks are like Mavericks.
I think it depends where they're racing. I like the truck show on a nice little short track where they can lean on each other and, as we like to say, beat and bang a little bit. But I will challenge anybody to say that yesterday's race at Dover was predictable. I mean, the way that came down to literally the last lap and where people were running decided who went on to be in the chase. So there was little to no predictability in that race yesterday.
A couple of things that have come in over the transom while we've been talking, because we put a little social media question. Have NASCAR's changes in cars and people over the years made it more fun to watch? In response to that question, David says the answer might be indicated by how many people are sitting in the stands. Attendance and interest seems to be declining over time. Agree or disagree with that?
As I said earlier, I think all sports are cyclical. I think you go through periods of growth, and then obviously it drops off. And I feel like right now and I'm not just paying lip service, I think NASCAR is in a bounce back series. And I think a lot of it has to do with this new playoff format that creates tension, as we saw yesterday, and as you'll see this Saturday night out at Charlotte.
Talking about racing and technological changes and changes in personnel, when we come back in a little while, we'll talk about that here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Are these new technologies opening new competitive opportunities among drivers or teams, or merely leveling the playing field, or even making just making racing safer?
They are definitely making racing safer. When you talk about the competition level, one of the problems is it's harder and harder to get in. So the smaller teams, for example, have many fewer engineers. And so when NASCAR comes up with a rule change, like the low downforce package they introduced recently for Kentucky and Darlington, the smaller teams have a harder time because they can't go and throw 45 people at the problem. So the larger the team, the stronger the engineering base, the more responsive they are to the rule changes.
All right. You just said something I have to ask you about. The lower downforce package. Does this have something to do with the shorter rear spoilers? Is that what that's all about?
Exactly.
There was a reduction in horsepower this year, and there was this shorter rear spoilers. Horsepower was reduced from 850 to 725. And that seems to me to be counterintuitive in a sport that's built on speed and power. Why did they do it?
The problem is that as the faster you go, the more force you get from aerodynamics. So how much grip you have on the track depends how hard your tires are being pushed into the track. Mm-hmm. Some of that is the weight of the car. Mm-hmm. The rest of it comes from the air, and the air actually pushes the car into the track. And you can get 40-50% of your grip from the air. So you're talking about a very large amount.
So if they shorten the spoiler, there's less grip because there's less downforce of the air holding the back wheels down on the car, right?
Exactly.
So then they reduce the horsepower. Isn't that just zero-sum game?
But the law of unintended consequences kicked in on this too. They cut the horsepower back. Okay, you would think that's going to slow the cars down. But what it allowed was the cars to go faster through the corners when they didn't have to let off the gas, so they were making up for time that they lost on the straightaways by going faster in the corners, and actually for the first half of the year were setting new track records just about everywhere they went.
And NASCAR did this to make it safer, but they also did it to improve racing. They said it would make racing better, it would make the races closer. Has that proven to be the case?
I felt like, especially at two races that I watched this year where they used the low downforce package, which will most likely be what they race on the cars at the majority of the races next year, they were very, very competitive races at Kentucky and Darlington.
And drivers like Dale Earnhardt Jr. says he loves it. Denny Hamlin says that's the way racing is supposed to be. Is that because it gives them more control very quickly?
And that's because they were doing very well with the new package.
Okay, we're going to take a break and come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking racing in advance of the Bank of America, almost call it Coca-Cola, the Bank of America 500 this Saturday night at Charlotte Motor Speedway. Dr. DeAndre Leslie Pilecki is with us, physicist and author of The Physics of NASCAR, and Doug Rice, president of Performance Racing Network and veteran announcer this year. We've talked a little bit about the shorter rear spoilers and the reduction on horsepower and how that turned out. And this year there's also an automated pit road monitoring system and a controversial system on restarts, which includes video to make sure drivers don't get an unfair jump when the race gets going again after caution laps. Why these new systems and what has been the effect of them?
Well, one of the things that NASCAR achieved is the ultimate 1984 system to monitor pit road. Literally at every racetrack, and they're out at Charlotte Motor Speedway right now bolting cameras on to the top of the racetrack along the grandstands. And each camera is assigned a pit road area, and it's overlaid with lasers that they can tell how fast you come down pit road. Are you going too fast? How you pulled into your pit stall area? Did the front end of your car go over the line where you're allowed to go? Is the back end sticking out without being touched by human hands? It will automatically let the officials in a trailer know, here's a potential problem. And then they can run that back and replay. A human has to approve it, mm-hmm. but the system itself tells you that there might have been a situation. It's like it's like stop signs that have cameras on them where you get the ticket.
If this works, they'll take this into the NFL to mark first downs, questionable first downs. Next year, NASCAR will have new qualifications to compete in the Sprint Cup Series, and I understand the idea behind that is to help racing teams. In what way, to what end?
I think what you're talking about here, and this has not been fully baked out yet, they're talking about the relationships. As it is right now, each team is an independent entity, mm-hmm. and they go racing in NASCAR. They are independent contractors, whereas you take the Carolina Panthers, who are based
here,
not far from here, mm-hmm. they are a franchise in the greater scheme of the National Football League. the people that own race teams do not have a franchise. They have a race team, and they show up each week, and they pay their fee, and they go racing. And I think eventually there will be some type of model that will change dramatically the relationship between the race teams and NASCAR. How that comes out, and will that be a true franchise model? I don't think anybody knows yet, but
And the teams would want it to be a franchise model because it protects them from increased numbers of teams coming into the so-called league?
No, I really think where it would pay off, Mike, is if you go out of business right now, you have a race team, you have the Mike Collins race team, and you've been successful, but you decide, I want to go do something else, and I want to sell my race team. You don't have a lot to sell. You have a building, you have some cars. And that's pretty much it. And you've invested $100 million in it, and you're going to get back $15 million. And you don't have a guarantee of a team, per se, to sell somebody else. And they would like to be able to look at this as a true investment for the future.
So it would essentially become a right, if you decide to get out of the business, not anybody could come in until you sold them your PSL.
It's your PSL. Your place at the table.
Yeah,
exactly.
Your place at the table. All right. One racing team is going out of business. You mentioned going out of business. Michael Waltrip Racing has begun the process of shutting down their Sprint Cup Series organization. They're going to lay off a total, I think, of 217 employees beginning November 1st through April 15th of next year. Why? What's going on there?
They were putting a lot of money into the team, and they weren't getting results.
That's pretty cut and dry, isn't it?
Very, very good answer there. Their money partner came out at a press conference in Bristol.
That's said, Rob Kaufman.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He said, we are spending top 10 money, and we are not getting top 10 results, and you can't do that but so long. But that operation started unraveling 2 years ago when they were involved in a scandal at Richmond Raceway, the final race to get into the chase. They manipulated the finish by having some of their team members make pit stops when they didn't need to, and one of them spin out when he didn't have to ensure that a third team member got into the chase. NASCAR got wind of this, penalized him. The driver didn't go into the chase. A huge sponsor in Napa left shortly thereafter, and you just don't replace an $18 million sponsor.
And Waltrip's racing team has actually two. They field two, don't they, full-time teams out of Cornelius. What kind of impact will their disappearance have?
Well, there's going to be 217 people looking for
that's a lot of people.
New jobs, which is a real issue.
Can they be absorbed by other racing teams in the area? Because they're 90% of the teams are here. So.
Well, they are, but everyone is fully staffed. If you figure out how many people they're going to hire each year, it's not a huge number. And one of the other problems is that after the Richmond incident, if you look at where some of the people went, Chad Johnston, who's Tony Stewart's crew chief, and Rodney Childers, who is Kevin Harvick's crew chief, both came from the MWR organization and left because of the Richmond incident and the finances associated with that.
So as Rob Kaufman said, you can't have a top 10 budget and a top 10 resources and not be in the top 10 for a sustained period of time, which means that racing is about money. It's largely about money. Was it always that way? You have to have the money to build these cars. Was it always that way?
Yes. Not to the scale that we have now, but the better funded teams, when Richard Petty was winning all the races, he had more money and more resources than anybody else. And then other teams came along and applied that same metrics.
Well, the Rick Hendrick racing team has more money and more resources than anybody else. They're the most valuable team going. Joe Gibbs, I think, comes in second, and the Stewart Haas team is behind that. What impacts a team's value more? The number of sponsorships they bring in, which is revenue in, or the number of races that they actually win, which I guess it impacts how many sponsors they can bring.
It's all tied together. You can't separate that. The more you win, the more headlines you generate, the more sponsors are attracted to you. It is a lot easier to sell a $20 million sponsorship on a car if you're having success.
And when they bring that money in, where is it going? Is it going to pay the driver? Is it going to pay the technicians? Is it going to pay the physicists? Is it going to buy the equipment? Is it going into research and development? Where is it going?
Everything you just said. I mean, if you look at some of the rates, racing, doing research in racing is really expensive. If you look at, for example, wind tunnel rates, you could be talking anywhere from $1,500 to $2,000 an hour.
Yeah. Wow. It's a lot of money.
And you take a race team on the road, you're suddenly paying for hotel rooms and per diems for 25 people. And that adds up really fast when you have 36 race weekends a year. It takes a lot of money and support to have these cars go around the track.
Now, this has nothing to do with physics, I don't think, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. A couple of years ago, things began to change as so-called pretty boy drivers began to replace the grizzled drivers of yore. One of those first drivers was Jeff Gordon, who in 1999 signed a lifetime contract with Rick Hendrick Motorsports, and now he's announced he's hanging it up at the end of the season. What impact will that have on the Hendrick team and on the sport itself? He's a high-profile guy.
He's one of the highest. I mean, he has won four championships. He is third on the all-time win list. He's a first-round ballot Hall of Fame driver. He changed the face of NASCAR hugely. He made it more corporate. He also opened it up for a lot of females.
He did it, or people around him did it, made it more corporate?
I think his influence. He was, as you said, more clean-cut. He was more friendly to corporate America and his sponsors, DuPont and Pepsi-Cola, than maybe he was to the Joe Race fan. And that changed a lot of what happened after that. Jimmy Johnson was kind of Jeff Gordon 2.0 after that. And he also brought a lot of new eyeballs to the sport. He had a rainbow-colored car that kids liked. He was a good-looking guy, so women were attracted to watching Jeff Gordon race. So it wasn't all negative. I think it was just very impactful what he did for the sport.
And Jeff Gordon set a record for the most consecutive NASCAR Sprint Cup starts, and some have been calling him the Iron Man.
Those are words that I never thought that would be associated with me. It's just, I always thought of myself as the young kid and being the veteran. It's just something that I never really pictured or thought about. So it's a great accomplishment and something I'm really proud of. You know, I think it speaks volumes about how passionate I am about the sport of racing and my commitment to it.
Teammate Jimmy Johnson called Gordon's record staggering. How unusual is his record?
I think that the only person that can ever touch Jeff Gordon now for number of wins is Jimmy Johnson. And he would have to come on and win about 30 more races to get where Gordon is. But what he did was unprecedented. He is third on the all-time win list, only behind Richard Petty and David Pearson. And when Petty was racking up so many wins, they raced 60 times a year. Mm-hmm. So he had a lot more opportunities early on in his career to win races. So Jeff Gordon's one of a kind, very unique. And he will be missed in this sport because there will be people that will walk away when he's done saying, I won't pull for anybody else. And then other people may start pulling for the 24 car now with Bill Elliott's son, Chase Elliott, driving it. He will bring another group of people.
Now, Jeff Gordon, I think you said he was 45. Is that old for a driver?
I'm trying to think who's older than him who's active right now.
That's old for a driver now. Tony Stewart's retiring next year, and he is at that same age. You get to that mid-40s area, and your reflexes and how things work for you are not the same as they are when you're 25 or 30 years old, and that slips a little bit.
You mentioned Tony Stewart from the Stewart Haas Racing Team in Kannapolis. He's ready to take his foot off the gas at the end of next season, and here's what he said about why.
Next year will be my last year in the Sprint Cup Series, and you know, it was a choice that was 100% mine. There wasn't any pressure from anybody. If anything, it was the opposite. I had more people trying to talk me out of it than anything. So, you know, I think it's a scenario where everybody in their career at some point, you know, makes the decision that it's time for a change, and it's nothing that you plan. I think it happens. I think deep down, you know, when it's time to do something different, to make a change like this.
You know, when I listened to that several times yesterday, it sounded like Jon Stewart and his reasons for giving up The Daily Show. He lost the passion, and he thought it needed somebody passionate who could devote it to it. Everybody gets to that stage in their life, I guess, but it's just more shocking or alarming when you see somebody who is as successful as a Tony Stewart and who has the potential for making so much more money if he continues to say, okay, I'm done. I'm walking away.
I don't think money has ever been a factor in Tony Stewart racing.
No, but and you look at his on-track performance this year has been horrible. He is not contending. He's not getting top 10 finishes. He's not leading laps. And that's not the Tony Stewart that the fans have embraced. He is enormously popular. He is the last of his breed. There will never be another Tony Stewart, and I don't say that lightly. He won IndyCar championships. He won Sprint Car championships, Silver Crown, everything there is to win in NASCAR. He's won it three times. He has a throwback. He has a younger version of A.J. Fort. None of those are going to come along anymore. So when he goes out the door, a lot of legacy for automobile racing in general goes with him.
So what does that mean for the sport, for the fans, going forward?
I think trying to find another driver to pull for if you're a Tony Stewart fan is going to be more difficult than finding somebody to pull for if you're a Jeff Gordon fan, because he is very unique.
Both of these guys have been controversial, though, over their tenures, have they not?
I think Tony probably more than Jeff.
Maybe. Yeah. A lot more.
Yeah.
A lot more.
Yeah. But that's for things he did. I think Jeff was a controversial because he was a pretty boy.
Yeah.
He was changing the sport, right?
Yep. And he was a foil and a good rival for Dale Earnhardt for about 5 years. That was what motivated this sport, was who's going to win the 3-car, the 24. And you need that in all sports. You need good rivalries. And Tony's been in the middle of a lot of controversy throughout his career. But it seems like every time that happened, it always seemed to make him more popular, because there were a lot of people that liked that rebel. They don't want to root for the establishment. And Tony was anything but.
We're talking NASCAR on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. A couple of things that people have been writing as we've been talking. Ted writes, why aren't NASCAR cars able to use wet weather tires like most other motorsports do, allowing them to race when it's wet?
Well, having sat through the Petit Le Mans at Atlanta 1 year when it was a monsoon, I would say one of the great things about NASCAR is that when it rains, we go inside and we wait for it to stop raining. I mean, being out and watching it is not fun.
Well, you're the physicist here. Now, passenger cars have tread on their tires, and that's to grip the road in all seasons, all weather, but particularly when it's raining, and they have no tread on NASCAR tires.
That's right.
What's up with that?
They have no tread on the NASCAR tires because that gives them better grip, allows them to dissipate heat better on dry pavement. It gives them better grip, allows them to dissipate heat better.
Uh-huh.
So the minute you put the grooves in there, you're actually making it a lot easier for the tires to heat up. Now, the other problem is sort of financial. You know, the chances of running in the rain, although increasing lately, are pretty small. And Goodyear makes all these tires, and they make them by hand. And the amount of research that needs to go into finding a tire that would actually work really well for a very heavy stock car in the rain is going to be huge. And it's probably just financially not going to pay off.
Okay. Dennis writes in, somebody mentioned the wind tunnel. I think you did. You should ride by the wind tunnels at Mazeppa Road in Mooresville. Every NASCAR team uses them. Why would you want to ride by it? Can you go in?
I don't know if you can go in or not. I've been in a couple of the wind tunnels, and they're fascinating places. You talk about high tech. You know, those are the places where they run. There's a place in town called Windshear. I'm not sure if that's the one he's referring to. They have 190-mile-an-hour rolling road wind tunnel. So the car is actually
moving
on a track that's moving at 190 miles an hour while you're doing the aerodynamic analysis.
So of Tony Stewart and Jeff Gordon, who are leaving the sport this year and next, who gets inducted into the Hall of Fame first?
Jeff Gordon. Because he'll be out first. He will be eligible before Tony because Tony's going to race another year. And Gordon is as automatic as it gets. Both of them will be members of the Hall of Fame, though, when they're eligible.
What do you think fans can expect at this weekend's races, both the Xfinity race on Friday night and the Bank of America 500 on Saturday?
I think that Joey Logano and his teammate Brad Keselowski, who raced for Roger Penske, are going to be huge factors at Charlotte Motor Speedway Saturday night.
All righty. That's Doug Rice, president of Performance Racing Network, and Dr. DeAndra Leslie Pilecki, a physicist and the author of a really interesting book called The Physics of NASCAR. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.